From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, the Academy Award producers have sparked a firestorm by dropping four awards from the Oscar broadcast. Then Rachel Weisz plays an 18th century duchess fighting for the favor of the Queen of England in The Favorite.
Somebody compared it, mentioned Mean Girls to me, and I said, well, I see what you mean in that there are women, you know, hashing it out, but the stakes are quite a lot higher. The stakes are running the country.
And a New York-based big band traveled across the country to record an album at the U.S.-Mexico border. All that coming up on The Frame.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the soulfully authentic A Star is Born, starring Bradley Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott in their Academy Award-nominated performances for consideration in all categories.
And by Marvel Studios' Black Panther, now nominated for 7 Academy Awards, including Costume and Production Design, Score, Original Song, All the Stars, performed by Kendrick Lamar and SZA, and Best Motion Picture.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. The Oscars are in the news again, but for all the wrong reasons. Aside from deciding to go without a host for the ceremony, this week the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences announced that awards in 4 categories will not be presented as usual during the February 24th broadcast. Instead, those Oscars will be handed out during commercial breaks. The winners' acceptance speeches will not be seen by viewers either live or in their entirety. And that has created quite a backlash from many corners of the industry. I asked New York Times Oscar columnist Kyle Buchanan for details on the changes and the fallout.
Well, the Academy has followed through on something they've been threatening to do for most of this season, which is present 4 of the awards during commercial breaks of the Oscars, and then edit those later into a clip package that they will show on the broadcast. They announced the 4 categories that they're relegating to the margins. So they are cinematography, editing, hair and makeup, and one of the shorts categories.
So before we get to the reaction, let's talk about at least the Academy's motivation. The ratings for the Academy Awards have been plummeting. They're trying to figure out how they can boost the ratings and get the show under 3 hours. And it's not just relegating a couple of categories to commercial breaks. They've tried some other ideas, the most popular movie Oscar, which they quickly abandoned. And then there was some conversation about cutting some of the songs. So what is the Academy really trying to do? And what are the problems that they've run up against?
What are the problems, John? How long is this broadcast? It seems like every single suggestion, idea, brainstorm the Academy has had this past year is quickly met with controversy, backlash, and often backtracking. You mentioned a couple of them. Also, they ran into some trouble when they were going to not ask back last year's acting winners to present. Then Allison Janney got upset online and they reneged on that. It seems like every single step of the way this year, they are making decisions that not only alienate a lot of the core people who watch the Oscars and take part in the Oscars, but I think they're trying to address a problem that isn't the major problem with the Oscars. Yes, ratings are down, but ratings are down for everything. Ratings are down for the Super Bowl. If you cut the Oscars to the bone, you might have a short show, but will you have a good show? The jury's out on that.
Matthew Loeb, who's the president of the Below the Line Union, the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees, said, "We demand that the Academy reverse course." And the cinematographer Caleb Deschanel, who is nominated this year for shooting Never Look Away, said, "I find it depressing that they are doing this." And I have to say, they're not alone. Everybody that I've heard from and seen commenting has been very unhappy, especially the cinematographers.
Yeah, Rachel Morrison, who was the first woman to be nominated for Best Cinematography, she retweeted a tweet criticizing this decision. And Alfonso Cuarón, the director of Roma, who acted as his own cinematographer on that movie and who many expect will win the cinematography Oscar, put out a tweet that went viral that was criticizing it as well, sort of indirectly. But he said, "No one single film has ever existed without cinematography and without editing." You know, this is it's a show that's supposed to honor every single aspect of movie making. if the Oscars can't make these categories interesting, that's on them, because I think that they are interesting. I know growing up watching this ceremony, I was fascinated by this look behind the scenes. And certainly something like hair and makeup, the clip package that precedes that, is always incredible to watch. I love watching those transformations.
When you look at some of the decisions that the Academy has made over the past half year, is it possible they might rethink the decision to give these awards during commercial breaks and put them in the regular ceremony now?
It's possible, but there's not a lot of time. I think part of the reason this was only just announced or confirmed for real is because they realized there would be some blowback and they wanted to minimize that window in between the announcement and the actual Oscar ceremony, which is a week from Sunday. At this point, they are going through the run of show. They have to have this as tight as possible. I'm not sure that they're going to be able to make more decisions on the fly and do a redo on this idea in the way that they've had to in the past few. But anything can happen. If there's anything we've learned this season, is that nothing is hard and fast. The announcement even of an Oscar host, you can take that back 48 hours later. So we'll see.
And I think it's also worth noting that the president of the Academy, John Bailey, is himself a cinematographer. And I think a lot of people find it odd that that is one of the categories that's being shunted aside.
And Bailey's wife is an editor. And that is also one of the categories that is being controversially mishandled. The rumor is that they basically volunteered to take one for the team, or take two for the team in this case, by saying, you know, if we're going to put our money where our mouth is, if we're going to advance this decision, we will agree that our categories will be broadcast in this manner. And then the intention going forward is for four different categories chosen at random next year to get this same treatment. You know, the Academy has tried things like this before. There were years where they would give the Oscar out actually in the audience to try to reduce the amount of time that the winner would spend walking to the stage. I mean, I don't think people are tuning out because it takes 20 seconds to walk to the stage. Just make the show good. Worry less about how little time it's going to be and worry more about packing that time full of major moments. That would be my advice.
Yeah, and of course, we should remind everybody that this year there will not be an official host for the Oscar. That's the first time that that has happened since the Rob Lowe Snow White fiasco from 1989. So let's see if that at least shaves some time and makes the show a little bit more interesting. Kyle Buchanan is the Carpetbagger columnist at the New York Times. Kyle, always a pleasure. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you.
And last night, comedian Billy Eichner tweeted, quote, "Just heard the Academy is giving out Best Actress tonight in the parking lot of Rite Aid on Santa Monica and La Brea around 2 a.m. Coming up on The Frame, Rachel Weisz talks about her Oscar-nominated role in the very different period film, The Favorite.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the soulfully authentic A Star is Born, starring Bradley Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott in their Academy Award-nominated performances. Now nominated for 8 Academy Awards, including Best Picture and Best Adapted Screenplay. Kenneth Turan of the Los Angeles Times calls it passionate, emotional, and fearless. And AFI calls the film a stellar achievement in its own universe, for consideration in all categories.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Marvel Studios, presenting Black Panther. The LA Times raves Black Panther is the cinematic event of the year. Vanity Fair calls it a political and social triumph. USA Today acclaims Black Panther is a rousing cultural movement. And now nominated for 7 Academy Awards, including costume and production design, score, original song All the Stars, performed by Kendrick Lamar and SZA, and Best Motion Picture.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. We're continuing our conversation about the Oscars. We're now just a little more than a week away from the ceremony. And while a lot of the conversation recently has been about Roma and its 10 nominations, it's important to note that another film matched that number, and that movie is The Favorite. Directed by Yorgos Lanthimos, the movie is set in the early 18th century. Two women from very different stations in life, played by Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz, are competing for the affections of the Queen, played by Olivia Colman. We'll start by hearing a bit from my interview with one of those women, Emma Stone. It's from last year's Telluride Film Festival. And then we'll hear from Rachel Weisz.
These women are not only, you know, complex, but they're also kind of detestable in their own ways, lovable in their own ways. They're just, they're human. They're women that are completely human, and there's three of them interacting with each other. It's just a beautiful, that's hard to see, you know, three men on screen that are that fully formed, but much less women.
I really agree with everything that Emma just said. Yes, to have so many different colors to their characters, that they're kind, needy, cruel, sadistic, playful, sexual, everything. I mean, everything you could, ridiculous, absurd. They're all colors. They're all things. And you can never really pin their characters down and name them in just one simple way, which, as Emma so eloquently said, makes them human. We are all so many different things.
And typically, I think when we see two women fighting over somebody in a film, they're fighting over a man, not a woman, and certainly not the Queen of England, which also seems to be what is so important about this film.
Yeah, so it's about these very complicated women with appetites for love and for power, fighting each other over the love of the Queen, but also to survive. I mean, they're all trying to survive, and the stakes are very, very high. There was somebody who mentioned Mean Girls to me, and I said, well, I see what you mean in that there are women, you know, hashing it out, but the stakes are quite a lot higher. The stakes are really getting to run England, getting to, you know, if you're in the bed of the Queen and in favor of the Queen, if you're the favorite courtier, then you get to make the decisions about running the country. So the stakes could not be higher. You can send armies to war. You can decide how much money from the national treasury goes towards the military, goes towards the pantry of the palace kitchen, wherever your interest happens to lie. So yeah, very high stakes.
I want to ask you a little bit about acting for Yorgos. I remember talking with Colin Farrell and John C. Reilly around The Lobster, Barry Keoghan around Killing of a Sacred Deer, and they all said they don't understand how he works or what it is that he wants from his actors, but they kind of know it when they do it, but that he's very, I guess, kind of oblique about how he's describing what he wants in performance.
Well, I would say he isn't even oblique, because it's not that he says something mysterious, which you have to then interpret. He says literally nothing. So you're left there in the scene with the other actor, beautifully stranded and unprotected and alone, and the only thing he might say to you is something very, very not mysterious, like faster, which we all know what that means, or perhaps slower. Or I mean, it's very minimal. I would say minimal, pointillist, almost nothing. Somehow or other, he, you know, like a conductor who hasn't spoken to his orchestra, gets everyone unified into a similar tone. So it is mysterious how he does it, but he doesn't employ mystery. He doesn't kind of say confusing, strange, parables that you go, huh? He just says, do it a bit faster. So it's very ordinary and very odd all at the same time.
A lot of actors would find that both terrifying and empowering, maybe at the same time. What about you? How do you react to that kind of void of direction?
I love it, because it is scary and you are, in a way, vulnerable, and every take is like on the edge of a cliff and you just jump. But he wants somehow he wants to see what you're made of. And I think he brings out some very interesting things in people, because the way in which he works is you don't discuss it or analyze it, or there's no thought involved, no analytical thought. It's just, you just react. You act and you react. So it's very instinctive. Maybe I was going to say childlike, but only in that, there's no discussion. It's, I think it would be better if you did it like this or did it like that. There's none of that. So you just do it. So you're just on your instinct.
I want to play a scene. This is between your character, Lady Sarah Churchill, and Emma Stone's character, Abigail Marsham.
I am a person of honor, even if my station is not. Even if I were the last one left in this wretched place, I would remain a lady.
You're pretty when outraged. So my secrets are safe with you?
All of them.
Good.
Even your biggest secret.
Abigail. If you forget to load the pellet, the gun fires, makes a sound, but releases no shot. It is a great jape, do you agree?
Yes.
Maybe we will think of a use for it one day. Sometimes it is hard to remember whether you have loaded the pellet or not. I do fear confusion and accidents.
There's so much in that scene about the dynamic between your two characters. Do you remember shooting that scene and what it felt like and what it meant to the story?
Yes, I remember it vividly. I mean, there are three shooting scenes between myself and Emma Stone's character, Abigail. And it's kind of like a three-act play. In the first scene, I believe that I'm in charge and I'm teaching my protege, Abigail, to shoot. And I'm rather flattered by her attention. I have this beautiful young protege who thinks I'm pretty cool. And then in the second scene, this scene, she basically is... she threatens me with knowledge that I'm a lover of the Queen. And so I shoot this blank at her, which is pretty scary. And then in the third shooting scene, she just outsmarts me completely, and she's a better shot than I am. So it's really about the relationship between the two women, going from Abigail's innocence to experience to basically usurping me.
We're talking with Rachel Weisz about the movie The Favorite. When I think about this movie, it's early 18th century with obviously some modern touches in terms of dialogue and costume. I also think about movies like If Beale Street Could Talk, Black Klansman, Green Book, period films that are obviously set later after your story, but are unbelievably topical today. And I'm wondering, when you think about your film, what we can learn about modern day living from period films that maybe we can't take away from contemporary cinema?
You know, The Favorite could not be a more pre-feminist film. It's pre-20th century, pre-the 60s, pre-the pill, women's rights, pre-women having the vote. But it's odd, though, isn't it? Because it's a film about three incredibly powerful women, and at a time when a woman could run a country. I suppose it's about... I don't know if it's about feminism, though. It's really about women in power struggles with one another. But... Well, we've had a female prime minister in England, but there hasn't yet been a female president in America.
No, and there's some very strong and impressive women who are running for president right now.
It's very true. It's very true. Yes.
When you come out of a movie like The Favorite, that is obviously an exceptional film and that is well received, and that really, I think, surprises a lot of people, not only in terms of the way that it's received by audience, but by critics, does it change your perspective of what you want to do? Does it validate your idea that you can do something like this film and that it will be received, and that these are movies that other people are interested in making and seeing?
I mean, I'm thrilled that, I mean, Yorgos is a director that I approached after I'd seen a movie that he made in Greece, in Greek, called Dogtooth. And I approached him and, told him what a huge fan I was. We met in a pub in North London. And at the time, he said, oh, well, okay, I'm writing something right now, which turned out to be The Lobster. Yes, I'm thrilled that other people love his work as much as I first did when I saw it. It's definitely a completely unique point of view he has.
I love that idea, too, that you saw Dogtooth and said, rather than my waiting by the phone for him to call me, I'm going to go out and seek him out. I wish other actors did that, because I think there's a real lesson to be learned in being proactive about films that you love and are passionate about, and actually trying to figure out if there's a way that you can collaborate with the person who made them.
I tend to do that when if I love, sometimes you end up working with a person, sometimes you just end up having told them how passionate you feel about them. And, you know, both versions are lovely. I do that a lot. I do.
Probably good advice for other actors. Rachel, thanks so much for coming on the show. Good luck with The Favorite. And I guess I'll see you in a couple of weeks at the Oscars.
Thank you so much. Thank you. It's lovely to talk to you again.
Rachel Weisz has an Oscar nomination as supporting actress for The Favorite. So does the film's Emma Stone. Olivia Colman is up for Best Actress. Coming up on The Frame, the New York-based Afro-Latin Jazz Orchestra traveled to the U.S.-Mexico border to record an album. Let me fly
to distant land. You've seen the movie San Andreas, right?
Natalie, I'm gonna need you to stay calm, honey.
I've got some bad news for you. When the big one hits, the rock won't save you. Want to know how to get ready for the next major quake? I'm Jacob Margolis, science reporter and host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. Prepare yourself. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting The Favorite, now nominated for 10 Academy Awards, including Best Director Yorgos Lanthimos, Best Actress Olivia Colman, Best Supporting Actresses Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz, Best Original Screenplay, Best Costume Design, Best Film Editing, Best Production Design, Best Cinematography, and Best Picture of the Year. For your consideration.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Over the past year, several musicians have addressed the ongoing immigration debate through topical songs. And as the battle over the proposed border wall continues, we bring you a story about an entire album on the issue. Pianist and composer Arturo O'Farrell is the founder of the acclaimed New York-based Afro-Latin Jazz Orchestra. And last year, he embarked on an ambitious project. O'Farrell took his 18-piece orchestra to the U.S.-Mexico border, and that's where they recorded the live album, Fandango at the Wall. The Frame contributor Beto Arcos has our story.
It's a late Saturday afternoon at the Soraya, the Valley Center for the Performing Arts at Cal State Northridge. Arturo O'Farrell and the Afro-Latin Jazz Orchestra are doing soundcheck while rehearsing one of his signature compositions, the Afro-Latin Jazz Suite. It incorporates instruments and rhythms from South America.
It's a piece of music that we call All of the Americas, because to me, I really believe strongly that all the elements for jazz are incomplete without all the elements of the Americas.
The idea to create a Latin jazz orchestra came to O'Farrell back in 2001 after Wynton Marsalis offered him a home at Lincoln Center. Marsalis' original request, says O'Farrell, was to start a resident Afro-Cuban jazz orchestra. During a press conference to announce the orchestra's new home, somebody said to O'Farrell,
"Why not Afro-Peruvian and Afro-Colombian? Why not Afro-Mexican?" And I said, "That's right. That's correct. I can't just do this repertory orchestra. It has to explore all of the Americas, because the truth of the matter is that jazz is an inheritance, a legacy of a cataclysm called the slave trade, in which a people that were oppressed returned love and divine love and music that enriches all our souls. But it was not invented in the U.S. It was part of a fabric that we inherited that comes up through the Americas."
O'Farrell was born in 1960 in Mexico City, the son of renowned Cuban composer, arranger, and bandleader Chico O'Farrell and Mexican singer Lupe Valero. He was five when his parents moved to New York City. He remembers growing up in the shadow of his father.
You know, he was doing a musician's life. He was playing, rehearsing, recording. I got to see a recording of the Count Basie Orchestra. How crazy is that? Dizzy Gillespie would come to my house, or Machito, Graciela.
At age six, O'Farrell's parents enrolled him in the Manhattan School of Music, where he studied the classical repertoire, Bach, Mozart, Beethoven. Late at night, he'd sneak into his father's writing studio and improvise.
I would sit at the piano and I would make up music. But I thought I was like just conducting an orchestra, and I even provided myself with audience noise. And I think that's when the seeds for my life as a musician were really planted, when I just was back there creating my own sounds. And that's kind of where the seeds for being a composer were planted as well.
On a late afternoon during last year's Memorial Day weekend, O'Farrell and his Afro-Latin Jazz Orchestra took part in the Fandango Fronterizo, a celebration of Son Jarocho music and dance, in a most unusual venue, the Dividing Wall at the Tijuana-San Diego border.
I thought this was the most elegant activism. To actually take a physical barrier and use it as a symbol of unification.
O'Farrell first read about the annual event and its founder, Jorge Castillo, in the New York Times.
This man's a genius, and I thought this thing was so brutally touching to me. It just meant so much to me that Pueblo Conciencia, community and music making and the celebration of culture and dancing was so much more important than anything, any border wall that man could erect.
It's ironic. The wall is there to divide us, and at the end, it ends up bringing us together. And now it's bringing people from other places together, even it's getting bigger.
Jorge Castillo is a librarian, a son jarocho musician, and the founder of the Fandango Fronterizo, held every year since 2008 at the Tijuana-San Diego border.
The Fandango is very inclusive. It's a feast that is very inclusive to the community and to the world. So now this concept is going beyond Tijuana. It's going even further, you know, like it's expanding to the world through this Fandango at the Wall project.
In addition to the Afro-Latin Jazz Orchestra, the Fandango at the Wall concert included two major son jarocho musicians, Patricio Hidalgo and Ramon Hernandez. O'Farrell also invited jazz violinist Regina Carter, drummer Antonio Sanchez, Iraqi oud player Rahim Alhaj, and many other international musicians for a very special Fandango Fronterizo. 25-year-old saxophonist and woodwind player Alexa Tarantino says joining the son jarocho musicians was exhilarating.
I found it to be just so much more raw and pure, much more direct to the listeners. It just seemed like pure joy to me, and I loved it.
Abdul Rahman Amer plays trombone with the Afro-Latin Jazz Orchestra. He says during the performance at the wall, he looked up.
And there was a bird that crossed from Tijuana super easily to the U.S. side. I looked at myself, I'm like, I can't do that. Nobody can really do that anymore. That made me think about how important this was to our current time because, you know, everyone wants to build these tall fences, but no one really wants to build longer tables anymore.
Jacob Hernandez is a son jarocho musician based in Los Angeles and Tijuana and was a coordinator between the Afro-Latin Jazz Orchestra and the son jarocho musicians. He says Fandango at the Wall is about everything that the annual event represents.
It's about the larger relationship between our two countries and that border, that problem that we have to deal with and face, and this one story of how we came to face that problem.
For The Frame, I'm Beto Arcos.
A book has been published about the Fandango at the Wall project, and a related documentary is also in the works.
Podcasting is supported by Fox Searchlight, presenting The Favorite, now nominated for 10 Academy Awards, including director Yorgos Lanthimos, actress Olivia Colman, supporting actresses Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz, original screenplay, and Best Picture of the Year, now playing.